start by saying I am so envious of that necktie that Dr. all I got is this little white tab, and he has the solar system, and in the background is the kind of image we get from the Hubble telescope. It's just marvelous.
Well, I like wearing the universe's fashion accessory.
Yeah. But the only advantage of mine is that I was somewhat distracted at times in his wonderful talk because I was just looking at that necktie. And there's nothing at all interesting about my garb here, so you can pay more attention to what I have to say. We've already mentioned several times today Albert Einstein, and he was surely the greatest theoretical physicist of the 20th century. But what was arguably the most momentous scientific discovery of the last century was one that Einstein himself would initially not accept, namely the expansion of the universe. Contrary to the almost universal opinion of scientists at the time, in the 1920s, two men that Dr. Barr mentioned earlier, the Russian astronomer Alexander Friedmann and the Belgian mathematician Georges Lemaître, working independently of each other, had reasoned on theoretical grounds that the universe was not static, but expanding. Carefully documented experimental evidence for this surmise came toward the end of that decade with the findings of the American astronomers Edwin Hubble and Milton Humason at the Mount Wilson Observatory in California. Already in the mid-20s, and on the basis of meticulous examination of photographic studies of the night sky, Hubble had determined that many of the nebulae, that is clouds literally, detectable in the night sky were not within the Milky Way, which at that time was thought to be the whole of the universe, but rather these nebulae were galaxies in their own right. And Hubble and Humason subsequently detected that the light emitted from these galaxies was shifted toward the red end of the spectrum. And the most widely accepted interpretation of this so-called red shift ascribes it to the Doppler effect, which you might remember from high school physics. It means that the longer wavelengths associated with that end of the color spectrum are due to the receding of the galaxies from one another, as well as from us observers on Earth. In this sense, it's worth noting that the 2011 Nobel Prize for Physics was awarded to two teams of researchers who discovered that this expansion of the universe is actually accelerating. In other words, the galaxies are not only pulling apart from one another, but are doing so with ever-quickening speed. Just again, as an aside, I read a few months ago that some article in a physics journal recently pointed out a very interesting fact. Hubble himself never accepted the notion of an expanding universe, but yet it was his findings that led most physicists to come to that conclusion. And as a result of these findings, as I say, a large majority of contemporary astronomers and astrophysicists have concluded that at some point in the very distant past, and we've heard the number several times already today, about 14 billion years ago, the present universe took its origin from what is known as a singularity, a point sometimes described as being of infinite density and zero volume. Some theologians and religious thinkers have taken this event, which we normally call the Big Bang, to be the moment of creation, referred to in the book of Genesis and elsewhere in the Bible. One of the best-known assertions of this kind of connection between modern scientific findings and religious doctrine was made by Pope Pius XII in an address he gave to the Pontifical Academy of Sciences back in 1951. After stating his wish to give his hearers a summary of what he called the priceless services rendered by modern science to the demonstration of the existence of God. Pope Pius went on to give brief descriptions of various scientific discoveries, including those of Hubble. And while admitting that such discoveries did not provide absolute proof of creation and time, Pius came very close to such a conclusion when he claimed, and I'm quoting him here, "With that concreteness which is characteristic of physical proofs, modern science has confirmed the contingency of the universe and also the well-founded deduction as to the epoch when the cosmos came forth from the hands of a creator. Hence, creation took place in time. Therefore, there is a creator. Therefore, God exists. Although neither explicit nor complete, this is the reply we were awaiting from science and which the present human generation is awaiting from it." End quote. Now, even at the time when the Pope made that statement, a number of people, including Lemaître himself, who was a Catholic priest, felt that the Pope's conclusion was unwarranted. And I think it's noteworthy that Pope John Paul II, about 30 years later, was much more cautious when he referred to the same scientific findings. He gave an address to that same Pontifical Academy of Sciences in October 1981, and there he said the following: "Any scientific hypothesis on the origin of the world, such as the hypothesis of a primitive atom from which derived the whole of the physical universe, leaves open the problem concerning the universe's beginning. Science cannot of itself solve this problem. There is needed that human knowledge that rises above physics and astrophysics and is called metaphysics. And there is needed above all the knowledge that comes from divine revelation." End quote. Now, even though nowadays we normally speak of the notion of the Big Bang as a theory, instead of using Pope John Paul's somewhat weaker term, hypothesis, we should nevertheless recognize that the theory that there is but one universe and that it had a temporal beginning some 14 billion years ago is not unanimously accepted. Some cosmologists have suggested that the Big Bang at the origin of the present universe is only one of many expansions that have been going on in an oscillating universe that keeps expanding and contracting. And still others surmise that there may be numerous universes existing simultaneously, with ours just happening to be one in which conditions allowed for the development of human life and consciousness. And for this reason, it would surely be unwise for theologians and other religious thinkers to bind themselves too closely to the theory of the Big Bang, since no one has any way of knowing how this theory might evolve or possibly even be replaced in decades or centuries to come. As Father George Coyne of the Vatican Observatory has said, "The theology that weds the science of today is the widow of tomorrow." Nevertheless, this theory of the Big Bang is certainly the position that has gained broadest acceptance among cosmologists today. And if theology is to be true to the interdisciplinary character that's always marked it at its best, then it's incumbent on at least some theologians to reflect seriously on what this particular cosmological theory holds. In the words of the Jesuit scientist William Steger, "It's important for the theologian to take into consideration what cosmology and science in general reveals to us of the universe and of our place in it. Certainly, at least in some way, such a perspective and understanding enriches theological reflection and provides some of the detailed experiential points of reference from which we consider who God is and who God is not, and who we are in relation to God, and to one another, and to the world. End quote. And so it's in the spirit of Father Steger's words that I offer the following theological reflections on the Christian doctrine of creation. The roots of this doctrine lie in various parts of the Hebrew Bible, including hymnic passages like Psalm 104, with its praise of God, who, it is said there, spread out the heavens like a tent cloth and fixed the earth on its foundation, not to be moved forever. Or again, one could turn to God's powerful and lengthy questioning of Job out of the storm, asking, "Where were you when I founded the earth? Have you fitted a curb to the Pleiades or loosened the bonds of Orion? Do you give the horse his strength and endow his neck with splendor?" These and similar passages in some of the prophetic books do provide rich imagery for the doctrine of creation, including that ongoing divine preservation of the world that's known technically as creatio continua, that is, continuous or ongoing creation. There is, however, and this was pointed out by Dr. Miller and others today, no doubt but that the most widely discussed biblical text about creation is the opening of the book of Genesis. Its first verse has frequently been translated into English as, "In the beginning, God created heaven and earth." Now, this translation is indeed faithful to ancient versions of the Old Testament in Greek or Latin translation. Recent scriptural scholarship, however, has argued that the opening words of the Hebrew text should not be translated in exactly this way. The Old Testament scholars Richard Clifford and Roland Murphy, noting parallels with other biblical and Near Eastern cosmogonies, translate that verse instead as, "When God began to create heaven and earth, the earth then being formless and void, with darkness over the surface of the deep, and a wind of God sweeping over the waters, then God said, let there be light. And there was light." Now, the difference between that and the more traditional rendering may appear to be slight, but the newer translations do render less certain the long-standing traditional conviction that the opening verses of the Bible clearly taught a temporal beginning of the universe. For one could possibly interpret the beginning of the book of Genesis as implying an already existing earth, one that was formless, void, and dark, with the creative action then being that of introducing light, order, and eventually living beings into this primal chaos. In the words of the British scholar Wilfred Lambert, a specialist in Near Eastern archaeology, the opening verses of the book of Genesis are about the processes by which the universe we know reached its present form and make no attempt to delve into the question of ultimate origin. A further point noted by modern commentators is that the Hebrew verb, here translated as create, bara, is regularly used in the Bible only when God is the subject, whereas another Hebrew verb, asa, usually translated as make, is used with either God or human beings as subject. That implies that making is analogous to human manufacture, by which an object is fashioned so as to receive its particular character, whereas creating is not comparable to anything humans can do. God alone could create heaven and earth, whatever this activity might mean more exactly. In fact, it did not take long within the Christian era for speculation to begin about the precise meaning of this term, create. For the early Christians had to combat two heresies, Gnostic dualism and pantheism, that, however different they were from one another, had at least one point in common, the claim that matter was in some sense eternal. Almost from the beginning, Christian thinkers opposed an understanding of reality in which matter, as over against a form-giving God, was equally fundamental and primary, because this was judged to derogate from the divine sovereignty. For example, Tatian, a second century Syrian apologist, taught that matter was generated directly by God. For he said, if it were ungenerated, it would be a second principle, and in some respects equal to God. And in that same second century, Bishop Theophilus of Antioch argued explicitly against the eternity of the world. After commending Plato and his followers for acknowledging that God is unbegotten, Theophilus went on to criticize the Platonists for holding that matter is also uncreated and coeval with God. Theophilus said, if God is uncreated and matter is uncreated, then according to the Platonists, God is no longer the creator of all things. Moreover, he went on, what great thing would it be if God made the world out of existing matter? Even a human artist, when he obtains material from someone, makes of it whatever he pleases. But the power of God is made evident in this, that God makes out of what does not exist whatever God pleases, and the giving of life and movement belong to no one else but God alone. End quote. And then a bit later in that same second century, Saint Irenaeus of Lyon, the most important of the second century Christian theologians, made the same point when he wrote, humans indeed are not able to make something from nothing, but only from existing material. God, however, is greater than humans, first of all in this, that when nothing existed beforehand, God called into existence the very material for his creation. Texts like these contributed significantly to the Christian doctrine of creation out of nothing, creatio ex nihilo. Saint Augustine of Hippo, the greatest theologian in the Western Church during the patristic era, pondered the question of creation at still greater length than any of the theologians I just mentioned. Augustine's reflections on creation and time in Book 11 of his Confessions are still regularly cited by philosophers. Above all, Augustine's insight, and Dr. Barr pointed to this out earlier, it's pointless to ask what God was doing before he created heaven and earth, because time itself was created at that point. In Augustine's words, this is from his Confessions, it's therefore true to say that when you, Lord, had not made anything, there was no time, because time itself was of your making. And no time is co-eternal with you, because you never change. Whereas, if time never changed, it would not be time. End quote. So in those early Christian centuries, any teaching about the eternity of matter was roundly condemned. In the Middle Ages, it was even thought by some theologians, such as St. Bonaventure, that one could prove philosophically that the world had a beginning in time. But his still more influential contemporary, St. Thomas Aquinas, disagreed, and Thomas's position is now widely accepted. Thomas's basic argument is that the articles of faith cannot be proved demonstratively, and that God's creation of the world is clearly such an article of faith. In fact, the very first article of the Creed, I believe in one God, Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. Therefore, according to Thomas, the temporal beginning of the world can be known only by revelation. And for him, that revelation was manifest in the very first words of the Bible, which he quotes from the Vulgate and not from the Hebrew, so he didn't know of these more recent translations from the Hebrew. For Thomas, it was simply, in principio creavit Deus caelum et terra. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. And so Thomas's answer is accordingly clear and concise. He writes, by faith alone do we hold, and by no demonstration can it be proved that the world did not always exist. And in replying to one of the objections to his position, Thomas notes that even some, like the Islamic philosopher Avicenna, who claim that the world is eternal, nevertheless do not reject the word creation, for they understand the term to mean that the world was not made from something else. And Thomas's comment points to a distinction regularly found among theologians and philosophers who write on this subject today. Although most people probably understand God's creation of the world to imply that the world had an absolute temporal beginning, what's sometimes called historical origination, in the most fundamental sense, creation means only the dependence of the world upon God, what is sometimes called ontological origination. And again, that was a distinction brought out very nicely by Dr. Barr with his example of a piece of paper eternally illuminated by a lamp. Emphasizing this latter meaning, this ontological origination, the late scientist theologian Arthur Peacock wrote, the principal stress in the Judeo-Christian doctrine of creation is on the dependence and contingency of all entities and events other than God himself. It's about a personal relationship between God and the world, and not about the beginning of the earth or of the whole universe at a point in time. And similarly, Keith Ward, who is Regius Professor of Theology at the University of Oxford, states similarly, and I quote, it is irrelevant to a doctrine of creation ex nihilo whether the universe began or not. That the universe began was usually accepted because of a particular reading of the first verse of Genesis. The doctrine of creation ex nihilo simply maintains that there is nothing other than God from which the universe is made, and that the universe is other than God and wholly dependent upon God for its existence. End quote. This distinction drawn by Peacock and Ward is important for the science and religion dialogue because it indicates that a theology of creation need not be wedded to a particular cosmological theory that the universe had a beginning in or with time. And although it's difficult to see how the existence of an eternal oscillating universe could ever be scientifically confirmed, even the possibility of its existence would not pose problems for the theologians like the two I just mentioned. For others, however, This note of temporal, or sometimes called historical, origination is much more important. The prominent German Lutheran theologian Jürgen Moltmann, for example, fears that if the notion of creatio ex nihilo were simply reduced to the giving of form to a not yet actualized primordial matter, then we would, of course, have to consider the world process to be just as eternal and without any temporal beginning as God himself. And this, Moltmann alleges, would lead to pantheism, because, he says, the world process would then be one of God's natures. And in this case, we would have to talk about the divinization of the world. God and nature would be fused into a unified world process. And an American theologian, also Lutheran, Ted Peters, out in Berkeley, is likewise wary of attempts to emphasize creation as ontological dependence at the expense of creation as implying a temporal beginning. Peters asks, why are we so quick to give up the idea of an initial origin? To reduce creatio ex nihilo to a vague commitment about the dependence of the world on God, though accurate, really doesn't help much. It simply moves the matter to a higher level of abstraction. We still need to ask, just what does it mean for the world to owe its existence to God? And a sensible answer is, if God had not acted to bring the space-time world into existence, there'd be only nothing. In other words, retaining this emphasis on an initial origin for Peters and Moltmann is something altogether in accord with discussions already taking place within scientific cosmology, and they think it offers theology an opportunity for fruitful dialogue with science. And I might add that one very prominent scientist would join the theologians Moltmann and Peters in so arguing. Francis Collins, the longtime head of the Human Genome Project and the current director of the National Institutes of Health, writes the following in his book, The Language of God. Quote, the Big Bang cries out for a divine explanation. It forces the conclusion that nature had a defined beginning. I cannot see how nature could have created itself. Only a supernatural force outside of space and time could have done that. End quote. As I come to this final section of our presentation, I therefore ask, what relevance does the theory of the Big Bang, so widely held by contemporary scientists, have for our understanding of the doctrine of creation? How should we even go about trying to answer such a question? To begin, it's important to note that the very methodology of science that has allowed it to make such wonderful progress since the 17th century nevertheless has inherent limitations. Science as such deals with empirically verifiable data. The Polish bishop Joseph Kaczynski, who is also a trained philosopher of science, has pointed out that the methodological principles of modern physics imply that any physical state should be explained by reference to an earlier state. For methodological reasons, the scientific series of explanations in the past of the universe should be continued ad infinitum, unless one proves that at a particular moment there must be introduced into cosmic history an absolute zero, much as the absolute zero of temperature must be accepted in Kelvin's scale. End quote. But we've already seen that there can apparently be no absolute proof that a singularity at the beginning of our universe corresponds to an absolute beginning of time. Since the theory of an oscillating universe, even if in itself undemonstrable and perhaps very unlikely, remains tenable, at least in the opinion of some scientists. And for this reason, Professor Wenzel von Hustein at Princeton Theological Seminary writes, "The why of it all, the ultimate explanation of existence, turns out to be unanswerable in terms of scientific methodology." And likewise, Ted Peters observes, "The scientific method cannot deny the existence of the beyond," that's with a capital B implying supernatural existence, "but it cannot affirm it either. The beyond lies outside the perimeter of scientific knowing and always will lie outside." Now, Ted Peters' comment in particular, with its reference to the beyond, capital B, correctly implies that the notion of creation is a properly religious one. It's understandable that persons who are already imbued with a religious perspective on the world, such as Pope Pius XII back in the 1950s, would readily interpret Big Bang cosmology in theistic terms. But the way in which he did so will almost inevitably not be convincing to those who do not share his basic religious perspective. Even in the extremely unlikely case that it could somehow be shown conclusively that our universe originated in a so-called singular event that was not preceded by the contraction of an earlier universe, and if it could be shown conclusively that ours is the only universe that is or ever was, this would still not allow cosmology as such to demonstrate the existence of a creator. A non-theistic scientist or philosopher could still say, in the words of the atheist Quentin Smith, that this world exists improbably and causelessly. It exists for absolutely no reason at all. It is inexplicably and stunningly actual. The impact of this captivated realization on me is overwhelming. I'm completely stunned." End quote. And for this reason, I think one would surely have to agree with Pope John Paul II when he stipulated that science itself cannot solve the question of the universe's beginning. As John Paul said, "There is needed that human knowledge that rises above physics and astrophysics and is called metaphysics." Among other things, this should caution a theistic philosopher or theologian from relying too closely on a particular cosmological theory when pondering the issue of creation. The best starting point will not be the theory of the Big Bang, but rather the very fact that the universe exists. That Polish bishop scientist whom I mentioned earlier, Joseph Szyszynski, recalls that in a 1992 interview, the well-known British physicist Stephen Hawking pointed out that even his physical description of a so-called no-boundary universe does not explain why the universe exists at any particular moment of cosmic time. And Bishop Szyszynski commented, "In this profound remark, we can find an echo of the philosopher Leibniz's question, why is there anything rather than nothing?" To be sure, one could still say, in reply to Leibniz's question, that the existence of the universe is simply a matter of random chance, something inexplicable, causeless, and ultimately pointless. We just heard Quentin Smith hold that position, and in another of his works, in a similar vein, Smith writes, I find it quite easy to conceive of the universe beginning to exist without a cause. I find such an uncaused beginning astonishing, amazing, mind-boggling, and utterly awesome. But that's different from saying I cannot conceive it to be the case. For many, however, including myself, it is philosophically far more adequate to argue that the universe is not causeless. William Lane Craig's critique of Smith's position is, I believe, trenchant. Craig writes, "On the theistic view, the potentiality of the universe's existence lay in the power of God to create it. On the atheistic interpretation, on the other hand, there did not exist even any potentiality for the existence of the universe. But then it seems inconceivable that the universe could come to be actual if there did not exist any potentiality for its existence. It seems to me, therefore, that a little reflection discloses that our mental picture of the universe arising uncaused out of absolutely nothing is just that, pure imagination. Philosophical reflection reveals it to be inconceivable." End quote. To say that the universe is not causeless, but that it finds its ultimate source in God, is to make a claim for which ineluctable proof cannot be given, for otherwise there would be no counterpositions, such as that held by Quentin Smith or Steven Weinberg or many others of that persuasion. But it is nevertheless a claim that is reasonable, coherent, and able to be understood as what Keith Ward has called the completion of that search for intelligibility that characterizes the scientific enterprise. It must be emphasized, however, that a genuinely theological doctrine of creation says something different from and much more comprehensive than what could be deduced from any cosmological theory. The Polish philosopher Michael Heller rightly points out that an historical analysis of the development of this doctrine shows persuasively that the theological idea of creation is immensely richer than anything physics or cosmology is able to say. For it holds not only that every moment of time, and not just some first moment, comes from God's creative power, but also that everything that exists is properly to be viewed within the context of a divine love that brought it into being and maintains it so. This means, as the South African cosmologist George Ellis points out, that the proper context for reflecting on the why of creation is not simply that of physics or chemistry, but that of what Ellis calls the full nature of our existence, with all of our fears and hopes, our love and caring, our value judgments, ethical choices, and moral responsibility, whose reality I take to be at least as indubitable as any other area of experience. End quote. This just occurred to me. I might interject here. I mentioned a few minutes ago this book, The Language of God, and by Francis Collins. If you read that, it's a wonderful book, very interesting. He came to his belief, not at all through his science, but through this, what Ellis here refers to as the reality of ethical choices and moral responsibility. Very interesting. At any rate, it's not merely pious sentimentality, but respect for the full expanse of human experience to consider creation from this broader perspective. And that means taking to account what poets, mystics, and religiously sensitive persons have had to say. And among them, there'd surely be numbered that the late Jesuit priest scientist Pierre Teilhard Chardin, who in the very midst of his paleontological expeditions and Mongolia and elsewhere in the Far East, would regularly reflect on the earth and the surrounding universe as God's creation, as when Teilhard wrote, "In the beginning was power, intelligent, loving, energizing. In the beginning was the Word, supremely capable of mastering and molding whatever might come into being in the world of matter. In the beginning, there were not coldness and darkness, but the fire, and this is the truth. So far from light emerging gradually out of the womb of our darkness, it is the light existing before all else was made that patiently and surely eliminates our darkness. You, my God, are the inmost depths, the stability of that eternal milieu without duration or space in which our cosmos emerges gradually into being and grows gradually to its final completeness as it loses those boundaries which to our eyes seem so immense." And the sacramental view of the world evident in those lines from Teilhard Chardin are reflected as well in the poetry of someone like Gerard Manley Hopkins, one of whose best-known poems, God's Grandeur, ends with the lines, "Nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, O morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with awe bright wings." I think it's not at all fanciful to suggest that we, living well more than a century after Hopkinson's death, and are far more conversant than he could have been about the immensity of the universe and the complexities of its structure, are in a much more privileged position to sense something of that grandeur of God of which he wrote. William Steger notes, "Material reality is on every level more vast, more intricate in its structure and development, more amazing in its evolution, in its variety flowing from fundamental levels of unity, and in its balance of functions, than we could have imagined without the contributions of the sciences." End quote. To have learned this from contemporary scientific cosmology is surely more conducive to a full appreciation of the doctrine of creation than any particular cosmological theory could be.